Musings Podcast with Fairbairn and Russell. Hello and welcome to the Market Musings podcast, where today we have, it's a first on this podcast, I think, we have a prospector on the podcast. His name is Brian Fowler. He's calling us, I think, all the way from Canada. Is that right, Brian? Welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm doing very good, Mark, and you're correct. I'm living here in central part of Canada in Manitoba, We have a pretty nice snowy cold day today.
A pretty nice snowy cold day. Okay. Have you seen the snow up in Scotland yet, Kenny?
No. Hi, Brian. How you doing? Just for the record, I know Brian for a good few years, so we speak most weeks. But no, weather-wise in Scotland, there's none, no snow yet, Mark. But you guys are coming up this week, and I believe there's some forecast. So. Yeah, we'll see. It's definitely cooling down now. Winter is definitely upon us in Scotland, but certainly not as cold as Canada is at the moment. But no, it's great. It's great to have you on, Brian. And as Mark says, we've had geologists, we've had CEOs, chairmen, directors, investors, people from all walks of life. But we've never had a prospector on. So I'm kind of looking forward to this because it's a you're coming at things from a different angle. So I guess,
I can tell you, I got my interest in rocks and minerals at a pretty young age. My grandfather, Arthur Wright, got me interested in rocks probably about the age of 8. And I used to be fascinated going over to my grandparents' house and looking at all the rocks that he had collected. He was a miner and prospector for many, many years. And we had a great association through that. In fact, I ended up working a few summers with my grandfather in Northern Ontario. And it was one year that we were just traveling along the Northern Superior Highway just to stop in and have supper with a geologist friend of his, David Bell. And David at that time was running a very small drill program in Hamlo for a couple of the junior mining companies that he was consulting for out of Vancouver. And David had asked me if I wanted to work with him. And I was just going home to look for work anyway. So I thought, sure, I'll stay. And that's how my involvement began in the Hemlo camp. I worked for David Bell on that drill program. We happened to hit some very good holes. This is back in 1982, and David made a very significant discovery. It was drill hole number 76 of the drilling on the Golden Scepter Glyph properties, and that eventually became the Hemlo deposit. So I worked for David for about another 6-8 months on that project until it was bought out by Noranda, and then started working for Noranda, their exploration team at Hemlo. And I stayed with Noranda for 5 years until they built the mine, and then actually got a job working in the mine. So my initial prospecting with my grandfather that I thought was going to only last 2 weeks ended up being 27 years in Marathon.
It's a fair old time. And just to step back further, Brian, where did you grow up? Were you born in Canada?
Yes, Kenny. I was born in Toronto. Don't hold that against me. my parents Moved around a little bit in and around the Toronto area until such time that I grew up and graduated high school. I'd always wanted to see the Rocky Mountains, so I hitchhiked out to Alberta as soon as I graduated high school. I spent 5 years in Alberta. I ended up working in the oil fields for a while. And then, of course, because that business is cyclical, just like the gold metals market is, we had an oil bust and I ended up coming back to Ontario. And I guess that's where I ended up meeting my grandfather to go help him out prospecting for a couple of weeks on a property that he was working on. Actually, he was working for Don McKinnon, one of the original prospectors that found the Hemlo deposit.
Yeah. And just probably for the benefit of our listeners as well, Brian, so define prospecting in your terms, because there's, you know, you see all these programs and discovery and all the various, I can't remember what they're called in the States, you know, the gold rush type things. I mean, they're classed as prospectors, but I guess it comes in all shapes and forms, depending on what you're, you know, what part of the food chain, you know, whether you're actually, you know, just staking the property and then passing them on to somebody else, or whether you're actually trying to get some gold out of the property. I mean, where do you sit in the chain?
Well, you're absolutely right, Kenny. I mean, prospectors have evolved over the years. I can tell you my grandfather, many, many stories that he shared with me. And he lived to be 101, by the way. But he used to go in the bush in the summer and come home 4 months later. And that was after many portages and living in a tent out in the middle of nowhere, really. And those were the old time prospectors. And there's not too many of those guys left anymore. My love is to bang rocks. I like to take a hammer in a bush and turn over as much moss as I can and look for rocks. That's what gets me very excited. I've since moved out of Ontario to Manitoba. And since I've been in Manitoba, I'm much more limited as to the time I can spend in the bush because the majority of my property is back in Ontario. And so now I spend a lot of my time researching properties. I'm more of a armchair prospector, unfortunately, but I've stayed in touch with the business all these years, and I like to spend as much time as I can in the field.
Yeah, and you've actually sent me a picture, Brian. You've got a whole room that's dedicated to you know, prospecting, and it's just like a mountain of books and maps and just everything under the sun.
Yeah, I was very fortunate, Kenny, over the years to inherit a nice library. David Bell, after he found the Hemlo deposit, you know, being a family friend at that time, and he was kind of getting interested in exploration over in Europe and also in Cuba, I believe it was at the time. And he didn't really have any need for his library anymore. He had won a large library as part of Prospector of the Year Award for finding the Hemlo deposit. It consisted of the original series of both provincial and federal reports from Ontario and Canada that date back to about the 1860s. And so I was very excited. Of course, I drove down there to collect it. And so I have that now in my dining room. I had to make some space here. It was either the dining room table or my library, and I chose the library. So I sold the dining room table. I've got about 70 boxes of books in the dining room and three filing cabinets with information from my properties in the Scriber Hemlo camp.
Yeah, and I guess I know a lot of this stuff is online now because I've had a play around with some of the mineral mapping systems in Canada as well. But not everything's online. And a lot of these maps are hand-drawn and probably handed down from father to son. So some of the stuff's priceless.
Yeah, I mean, it's priceless to me. You're right. A lot of the vast majority is online. Ontario has an excellent website for geology maps and publications. There are some old reports, like the ones I mentioned from the 1860s and 1870s, that were out of print at the time and couldn't be scanned, weren't available to be scanned, to be put online. And so those would have been lost. So they're valuable to me. My one favorite book would be from the 1860s, when Sir William Logan was the first geological surveyor of Canada. And he actually has his signature in that book. So that's quite a personal item for me.
Yeah, decent bit of history as well. It's amazing. Yeah, you know what you can do. As you say, you're an armchair prospector now. But I mean, you've got the best of both worlds. You've got this fantastic library, and then you've got all these resources at your fingertips. But I wonder if I could just get a general overview. So obviously, at the moment in Hemlo, Ontario, there's massive interest. I mean, I'm trying to think from memory. I think there's Teck, Newmont, Hart, Barrick Gold. They're all mining there, and there seems to be a massive influx of particularly UK companies as well. It's a bit like when the Beatles went to America, everybody else followed. And I'm not saying that Panther Metals is the Beatles, but that was the first company that kind of sort of popped up in the LSE that were actively exploring in Hemlo. And obviously since then, Power Metals has joined the game. And there's a few private companies as well, First Class Metals, which is in the pre-IPO stage, and also Fulcrum Metals, which is in the pre-IPO stage. So what is the attraction in Hemlo at the moment, Brian? There's obviously a gold rush, or just a metals rush going on.
Yeah, Hemlo is a strange beast. You know, when they found the deposit back in 1982, it turned out to be, within a few years, the largest gold ore body in Canada. They ended up building three mines and sinking shafts into the Hemlo ore body, which is a single ore body. And they've been producing gold since 1985, and they still are today. And during the Hemlo discovery, there was just a massive rush of companies, something I've never seen before. I'm not sure if I'll ever see that again in my lifetime. But there was well in excess of 300 companies, helicopters flying all over the airspace there, staking claims. At that time, it was the largest staking rush in Canada. I think it has been since surpassed by the diamond rush in northern Canada. But within 3 or 4 years of that staking, very little work was actually done on the ground by these companies. It was really a stock play. Yeah. And companies were making a fortune off their share price just by announcing they had a position in the Hemlo camp because the discovery itself was so big. And the funny thing is, you know, out of maybe a handful of these companies, nobody actually set foot on the ground. They flew a few airborne surveys, this sort of thing, but it was, you know, that's all it was. And because there weren't any subsequent discoveries after Hemlo, the belt essentially sat dormant for years, despite you know, having the largest gold ore body in that greenstone belt. And just within the last, I would say, 3 years, there's been a real resurgence into the Hemlo camp. And I don't know quite how to explain it. You know, I think there's a lot of factors that are involved, you know, rising gold prices, that sort of thing. But we now have in excess of 40 companies between White River and Scriber, which is the length of the Hemlo belt. It's about 160 kilometers long. And more recently, we've had a real influx of interest and companies coming into Hemlo from the UK and Ireland. So there's been a really large UK invasion, so to speak, in the Hemlo, Scriber Hemlo belt in the last short while.
Yeah, I've heard that. I was talking to another prospector over in the area, and she said, yeah, there's she loves the British vibe that's going on over there. But I think it's a bit of a different world for me to try and understand, because you say you sort of just go and stake claims, and this geologist was telling me the same thing. She's got her own claims she staked, and yeah, she'll do a bit of digging around on there, you know. And it's, I think, for a geologist or someone interested in that, it's a fantastic place to be, because I don't think we can, certainly like on the island over here, you can't really appreciate the size of the whole area. I mean, these places, these camps, that the Hemlo camp, the Timmins camp, they're so big, aren't they? And you can just almost, it's pretty easy to go and stake a claim, isn't it? And go along and just, you know, a bit furting around, kicking rocks, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, there's Canada, obviously, it's a huge country. And vast in natural resources. So the Canadian Shield itself is a massive area of Ontario, Quebec. And there's actually a lot of open ground still in this country. I think perhaps that is because while Canada is so large, the population is not that great. We only have 38 million people, but I think we're the second largest country in the world area-wise. Mm. And when you get into the northern parts of the country, there's even fewer people. And also that means fewer roads and access into the area. So there's so many parts of the country still to this day that are very underexplored and may not even have seen a foot walk on that area.
Yeah.
I read somewhere, Brian, and you'll be able to confirm this, that there's thousands and thousands of lakes in Canada that have not even been named yet.
Yeah, well, we certainly have our share of lakes, particularly as you go further north. You know, it's just a vast wilderness, really. And that's why most of the discoveries to date have been reasonably close to highways, or often the forestry companies build these a network of forest roads that you will be able to access part of the country. But certainly, I mean, there's just vast amounts of ground that are really helicopter access to get to, that have tremendous potential.
Mm. Yeah. And despite the extreme conditions, Brian, obviously during the winter, I mean, I think you've spoke to me in the past and it's been like minus 30, minus 40, et cetera. You know, everybody just gets on with it. In fact, most of the drilling is done during the coldest time of the year. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right, Kenny. You know, for the most part, companies take advantage of the field season for mapping, rock sampling, soil sampling, boots on the ground between May and October. That's your key field season because it's quite short here in Canada. So typically, the drilling is scheduled for the winter. And it's often much more affordable because all of the lakes that you just talked about are frozen, and they can drag these drills in by skidder across frozen ground and not get bogged down. So it's actually more affordable to drill in the winter than the summer months.
Yeah, and obviously I think with everything being frozen as well, you know, there's a fair old weight in some of this equipment, so it's a lot easier to move around. It's not getting bogged down.
Yeah, and you also have additional targets that you wouldn't normally be able to drill in the summer that are quite often over lakes that are now iced over and become good drill targets.
Yeah, well, that's quite interesting. So they'll actually drill a frozen lake?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, it happens quite a bit in the winter. Companies take advantage of that.
That's interesting. So what happens if you, obviously, let's say the lake's, I'm going to say 15 meters deep before you hit the bottom. What happens if you make a discovery under a lake? I mean, I'm sure it's happened before.
Oh yes. I would say probably greater than 50% of the gold and base metal discoveries in Canada are adjacent to or under lakes. And because they're underground operations, it doesn't really matter. They go under the lake. And for the larger operations, they will drain the lakes. And in fact, as a matter of fact, if the deposit is big enough, they will move towns. I know of the Malartic discovery in Quebec, where they actually moved half of the town to build an open pit, because it was that rich of a deposit.
Yeah, you just don't mess around over there, do you? I mean, I suppose it's a very mining friendly jurisdiction. I think it's Nevada number one, and then I think it's two or three provinces in Canada is the next most mining friendly states in the world.
I think Nevada is probably number one. It's certainly a very rich gold state in the U.S. And they're very gold friendly. So they've had decades of mining there. People are well aware that mining can bring a lot of wealth to that state. In Canada, I think Saskatchewan might be the friendliest province to work in for mining companies. And that they would be followed by Ontario and Quebec very closely.
Yeah. That's something in my back of mind. I was going to ask you there as well, Brian, but it slipped my mind. Mark, have you got anything to drop in there
while you remember? There's still an awful. Would you say it's underexplored, Brian? Is there still an awful lot that can be discovered?
Absolutely, Mark. I mean, it's such a big country. There's so many wide open spaces that mining companies just haven't gotten to yet. And the interesting thing is, too, that even for those areas that are closer to infrastructure, closer to highways, and I can use Hemlo as a good example, the Trans-Canada Highway intersected that property, and over 40 companies took a crack at that over the last few decades. And it wasn't until the 76th hole of the 40th company that found the ore body. So
76th hole of the fourth company, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, it's an incredible story. It really is. And you know, sometimes it just takes a new set of eyes. Sometimes it's just the persistence of people to follow what they believe they're seeing in the drill core. You know, whether it's alteration or mineralization. And then, of course, obviously, it helps to have the financing behind you to continue to drill.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And why do you think there's been an influx of sort of internationals then rather than homegrown companies? And can you give a reason, do you think, or not?
Well, I think the potential for mining in Canada, particularly mining exploration and the wealth of the Canadian Shield, has really drawn a lot of companies here, particularly from the UK, also Australia. Australian companies are now seem to be flocking into Canada to take advantage of the opportunities that are here, because we have a lot of resources and a lot of underexplored ground still.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, it's a bit bizarre. You got a lot of Canadian companies flocking to Western Australia and Victoria looking for gold, and you've got a lot of Australian companies flocking to Canada to look for minerals as well. It's really weird how the way some of these companies work, but you know, it clearly works. The question I just remembered, Brian, was obviously we've mainly talked about gold in Hemlo-Schreiber, but that it's not just a one-trick pony. I mean, just at the top of my head, nickel, zinc, copper. I mean, it's pretty much, it's got the full suite of commodities.
Yeah, I mean, just even in the Schreiber-Hemlo belt alone, we have several past producing copper zinc mines, one in Manitouage. It was a world-class mine, GECO, ran for years and years, I think over 40 years. The Winston Lake mine out in Schreiber was a very rich, one of the highest grading zinc mines in the world, ran for about 8 years. It shut down and now currently being revisited by another company. In fact, they just put out a pre-feasibility study to put it back into production. And one of the largest copper palladium deposits in North America is sitting in the Schreiber-Hemlo belt by Marathon, or rather Generation Mining. And they also have a feasibility study and they're looking at financing to put that into production. So yeah, there's a wealth of metals here, whether it be copper, zinc, nickel, cobalt, palladium, gold. There's many, many opportunities, including diamonds, as a matter of fact, on the eastern edge of the belt, where diamonds have been discovered in the Marathon Schreiber district. So many, many opportunities for a wealth of metals.
Yeah, and of course, all these companies are drilling like mad just now, Brian, as well. I mean, this is drill season, but I had noticed that, I mean, companies like Palladium One, they seem to be drilling all the time, regardless of the time of year. Obviously, they've got the finances. I think from memory, that was a Tycho deposit. Now, that's quite close to some of the companies we're talking about, you know, Panther Metals, you know, First Class and Fulcrum.
Yeah, they have a great property. So many different prospects there, and they've only started to drill a few. They made a big discovery last year at Smoke Lake, quite high grade nickel, and they found that through drilling an electromagnetic conductor, because there's no outcrop, there's no bedrock to prospect there. And so it was just a blind hole drilling an electromagnetic conductor, and they hit a very high-grade nickel zone about 25 meters below the surface. And since that time, they've expanded their electromagnetic survey, and they've identified several other targets within that area. And it just happens to be the same area that I've sold a lot of the properties to the companies from England and Ireland. So that particular area of Hemlo is going to really heat up in the next short little while, particularly since one of the companies out of the UK, Panther Metals, is drilling a 400-meter hole at Dotted Lake, which is just to the west of where Palladium One has made their nickel discovery. So Darren and his people will probably have some news on that hole sometime in December or early January.
Yeah, and I think I'm just looking back at the news here as well. I think you know, First Class Metals, they've got a joint venture with Palladium One as well, which is quite interesting considering they're still pre-IPO.
Yeah, First Class Metals was a very aggressive at acquiring property, both through staking, and which can be done relatively cheaply, and as well as acquisitions. And I had sold six properties to Paul Johnston's group at Power Metal last year. Well, no, actually, it would have been this year. It would have been earlier on in the year, in January, February, March kind of thing. And recently, Power Metal vended out all those Scriber Hemlo properties to First Class in exchange for an equity position in First Class Metals. So at this point now, First Class has expanded their portfolio in that area at least threefold. And they're pretty well positioned between Palladium One and Panther Metals to make a pretty good discovery of their own over the next few months.
Yeah, and Mark, you've the woman you spoke to earlier on, the geologist, was it Francine you were talking to?
Yeah, Francine Long, yeah.
Yeah, so she's actually the geologist for First Class Metals. So, yeah, she's pretty active on Twitter. I've seen her posting quite a lot. I think she's a bit like you, Brian. She likes to be out in the field with a rock hammer and chipping away.
Yeah, I think Francine was out on the a few of the First Class Metal projects earlier this year in April, and I'm quite certain that First Class Metals will have some boots on the ground as soon as the season opens up again next year in April, May.
Yeah, and the only other company we've not mentioned, although they're a bit further, I think they're probably 3 or 4 months behind First Class Metals, is Fulcrum Metals. But again, they've been quite aggressive as well. I mean, they've built up a pretty significant land portfolio.
Yeah, Fulcrum is a really interesting group. They're out of Ireland. And I was trying to think earlier today how I got introduced to them. And I recalled it was Darren Hazelwood from Panther Metals introduced me to Aidan O'Hara. And we were originally talking about a copper zinc property I had in the Scriber Hemlo camp. That didn't come to fruition, but actually it's now owned by First Class Metals. That was one of their six properties that they acquired from Power. But Fulcrum, our discussions continued, and I got to know both Aidan and Ryan Mee from Fulcrum, and both good guys. And since then, we have sold them several properties. I think Fulcrum now has 6 or 7 projects in Ontario, and another one of their new startup companies, On Gold Invest Corp, has also acquired quite a few projects also in the Scriber Hemlo camp. So that group has a lot on the go right now. And I think they're also working towards an IPO later this year and a listing on the London market.
Yeah, it seems to be the flavor of the day. But then there's nobody else really in the London markets exploring in Hemlo Schreiber. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it pans out, Brian, because obviously Panther are drilling just now, and that's quite a meaty hole, 400 metres. And I think, I'm sure I've seen a picture on Twitter the other day, there was some core, and it looked quite interesting. Darren had tweeted it out. And obviously, Mark, you speak to Darren, you interview him quite often. Well, hopefully we should get some results from that drill hole. And yeah, that'll do wonders for the companies roundabout if those results. It'll do wonders for Panther mainly, but obviously, the companies roundabout benefit if there's a good hit from a drill hole.
Oh, 100%. In fact, 1,000% agree with you there. you know, the interesting thing about Hemlo is that because it is such a large ore body, and it was one of the biggest stock plays in Canadian history, people made millions. People also lost millions because they bought share prices so high. But it will go down as the single largest stock play in Canadian mining history. I can remember, you know, just from a personal note, I had shares of Golden Scepter, which was the predecessor to the Golden Giant Noranda mine, owned by Richard Hughes out in Vancouver. I had shares of that company. I wanted to go to Mexico for Christmas after working about 3 months in the bush. And my grandfather, I needed to sell the stock to pay for my trip. And my grandfather was getting mad at me and saying, well, don't sell that stock. They're gonna go a lot higher. And well, I was happy because I think I sold my shares at $4.50 and I only paid $1.50 for them. So I thought I was doing okay. Well, when I can tell you, when I came back on the plane 3 weeks later, the share price was $9. And 4 weeks after that, the share price was $62. So it was an incredible time. And many, many people in the business still remember Hemlo. It's right in the back of their mind. I can tell you, if Panther Metals gets a gold intersection in their drilling, that is going to be one of the biggest things in Canadian mining history of recent memory, because it is going to bring a flood of companies back into Hemlo, and there's not a lot of ground left. It's pretty much all gobbled up right now. But I think you're going to see a lot of joint ventures come out of it.
Yeah. So it's a perfect storm is brewing in Hemlo Schreiber.
Yeah, and Panther is in the best position right now to deliver with drilling at Dotted.
Yeah. Okay. We'll need to hassle Darren Mark and say get his finger out and get these drill results. We're all getting impatient. But I imagine they must be quite close to finishing that hole, Brian. I mean, 400 meters. I don't know what you can do in a day. Was it 15
years? I can't really comment too much on that. You know, I know drilling drilling here can be set back by a number of things, access, weather, things don't, mechanical breakdowns, things don't always go smoothly. And I'm not really, to be honest, quite sure where they are on that hole, nor would I even probably be able to say if I did know. I think that's got to come from the company. But I would have to suspect that they'll be in a position to be announcing some news on that drill hole in December.
Yeah, we look forward to that. So we do. That should definitely be a good boost for the area, if all is well. But it's interesting. I think we should get you on again, Brian, because I'm just looking at the First Class Metals website here, and you know, and they've got a massive footprint there, and they've got, you know, it's not just gold; they've got copper. I think there's nickel in there as well. They've got quite a decent commodity suite, so they have to come to IPO with.
Yeah, they really have a good variety of property now. Particularly after taking the Power Metal 6 projects, so they're spread out pretty good. They're probably one of the largest players in the Scriber-Hemlo belt now, and they have a number of commodities that they can go after. So I really, you know, if they have a successful IPO and listing and are able to put a good amount of money in their treasury, I think they're going to be a major player in 2022 in this area.
Yeah, and it's definitely, as you say, it's going to be an interesting 2022, and obviously drill season is upon us. So yeah, I'll be keeping a close eye on these companies. But no, it's been great having you on, Brian. Mark, have you got anything you wish to ask Brian? And about his past, anything he's done, about his best discovery or something, his most interesting. Yeah.
Well, my best discovery, I suppose, it depends on how you define best. I might define best as when I was the most excited in the bush. And that would be when I was in the North Limb of Hemlo with my partner at the time. And we discovered rocks and alteration that could be considered identical to that of the Hemlo deposit. I was very familiar with the Hemlo deposit. I split a lot of that drill core for those guys back in the 80s. And this was a lookalike. And I was doing high fives with my partner in the bush. Just fast track the story a bit. We showed that property to about 300 different companies over about a 2-year period in the field. And of course, rock assays always tell the story. And we could not get better than 50 parts per billion gold out of the surface. It was very frustrating. We were ready to give up on that property. And the geologist in Thunder Bay for the Ontario Geological Survey said, look, why don't you give this guy a call? He's the mine geologist at the Golden Giant Mine. He'd probably like to go for a weekend. He likes looking at rocks. And so we did that, and he got so excited. He was down on his hands and knees asking us, had we ever shown this property to anybody before? Of course, we just laughed. And about a week later, I got a call from John Harvey out of Toronto. John at the time was the president of Noranda Exploration. And he asked me if we still had the property available. I said, yes. And they bought that property within a few days. They flew up with the board of directors. We met with them and we cut the deal. And that particular property is now owned by Hemlo Explorers. And they have just spent about $2 million on that project this summer. Their drill results to date have been quite disappointing. But they're within a very large alteration system. And you know, you can't ignore that type of environment. Sometimes these ore bodies, they're very difficult to find. They could be at depths, but they typically give a halo of alteration from hydrothermal activity that have altered the host rocks, both in the wall rocks and hanging wall and foot wall rocks. So that imprint gives a much better feel for geologists and explorers to do more work. And they've got a great project. So in terms of my favorite projects, that would be it. I guess if best is construed as the closest to collecting a royalty, that would be my Geordie Lake deposit in the Marathon area. That's owned by Generation Mining. Generation, their main deposit, the Bamoose deposit, hosts about 90% of the ore in the property, and that's what they're planning to put into production. But they also have two satellite projects at Sally and Geordie. And Geordie is my deposit, and I share that. Typically, I share my prospecting life with other people because it's great to have partners. And my two partners in that project, one is from Kirk Lake, another one is from Southern Ontario. And at the time, he was a boiler operator, the fellow that is now in Southern Ontario. He ended up becoming a policeman. But at the time that I knew him, he was a boiler operator in the pulp mill. And he got talking to me one day in the boiler room about these rock samples that he collected, and he just happened to have one, and he showed it to me, and it was full of copper. And I got pretty excited, and I said, I'd really love to come out and have a look at that. And he said, yeah, sure. He says, we're going to go out moose hunting. That's where our moose hunting camp is. And if you want to come out with us for the day, we'll show you where I got this from. So again, to fast track it, I saw the rocks in the ground. There was disseminated chalcopyrite everywhere. And I told him, I said, look, you need to stake a claim. I showed him how to do it. We waited until he had that done. And a month later, I said, look, do you mind if myself and my partner go in and stake a much larger block around you? And he said, no, go right ahead. And so we staked about 30 more claims. And when we had that recorded, I went back to this boiler operator and I said, look, why don't we just pool our resources? We'll put all 31 claims into the pot. We'll split it 1/3 each. And we all agreed to do that. And within a few months, we had the property sold to a little junior out of Vancouver. And that property's changed hands a few times, but it's now owned by Generation Mining. And after drilling over the years, that Geordie deposit has about 42 million tons of copper palladium ore in a resource. So I think that might be the closest property I've had over the years that would be potentially collecting an NSR on. Whether or not it'll happen in my lifetime, I don't know.
Mm. Yeah, well, you actually stole my thunder there, Brian, because I was just going to say, obviously part of the prospecting model, well, with most of them anyway, is the net smelter royalty that you always retain from these projects. And obviously, you know, this particular one, although you're not realised any value yet, at some point there will be, you know, value from the sale of that royalty, whether it's before production or in production.
Yeah, that's every prospector's dream, to collect a net smelter royalty, to have a property that they've acquired that goes into production. And, you know, it's just, it would just be so much fun, for one thing, you know, to have something that I would have discovered or found or acquired and have it go into production. And then, of course, the, you know, the money is nice. You know, I'm getting older. So, and permitting takes a while. That particular deposit, satellite deposit, may not see the company go in there for another 10 years. And so in all likelihood, any net smelter will go to my son. But that's certainly every prospector's dream. I don't know if you're familiar with the newfound gold discovery in Quebec, or pardon me, in Labrador, Newfoundland. Yeah. And they just recently purchased the net smelter royalty from the three prospectors that sold them that property. And those guys did quite well. They both, I think all three guys got $2.6 million each in cash and shares for their net smelter royalty. So there can be a significant amount of money if it's a very good deposit. And clearly Newfound Gold has a very good deposit that they're developing in Newfoundland.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, it's life-changing money if you hit one of these NSRs. So yeah, it's always good to retain it. It just gives you that wee piece of the pie in case somebody does make a discovery. What actually happens then, Brian, with that? Obviously, if the property lapses, you lose the NSR. But I'm assuming if the company does a joint venture or sells a property on, you retain the NSR through the model.
Yeah, that's right. I try and retain an NSR for every property that I sell. You know, the money that you get whether it be cash or shares for the actual option is good. You know, it might get you, you know, a new vehicle sometime. It might get you maybe a week trip to the Caribbean, or it just might get you a few cases of beer. You know, it's not a tremendous amount of money. It's fun. It's nice to make money, but the real money is in the NSR. But you know, that's a real long shot. I think, you know, to be realistic, I think it's about 1 in 1,000 properties actually has a resource on it, of a drill indicated resource. And then another 1 out of 1,000 of those becomes a mine that actually goes into production. So, you know, your odds are about 10,000 to one. If you have a property with a good showing on it, that'll go into production, but certainly better than the lottery.
Yeah, definitely. But all right, well, it's been fascinating, Brian. Like I say, I could sit and talk to you all night, because you know I love this mineral mapping stuff, and I'm a right nosy bugger. I like to look at everything that I can find about a particular claim or a showing or whatever. So it's right up my street. Mark, have you got anything to add before we finish off?
No, I think I'm good. We pretty much covered everything that I was thinking of. I like what you said about Panther. It tempts me to buy some shares.
Well, I'm not promoting Panther.
No, of course not. Yeah, no promotion, no financial advice. But
And of course, I'm very biased because I sold them that property. All I can say is if they happen to hit a hole, hit a nice drill intersection, it's certainly going to make a lot of noise over here in Canada. I'm not sure about the London market, because you folks may not be as familiar with what's happening here, but from a Canadian perspective, it's going to gather a lot of attention.
Okay.
Oh, good stuff.
Good. Yep. Well, excellent.
We'll look forward to that, and you can interview Dan. In fact, we're not Dan on for a podcast for a wee while, have we, Mark? I think we should drag him on and shoot the breeze. Well, that's Australians that say that, isn't it? It's not Canadians. Yeah, I'm losing a bit. Brilliant. Well, thanks a lot for your time tonight, Brian. Like I said,
you're most welcome. I appreciate you having me.
And I'll probably speak to you for about another half an hour after this podcast, no doubt.
All right, then.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Brian. Been good to talk to you.
Okay. Thank you.
Cheers.
Have a great evening.
Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Ben and Russell. Tune in next time.